Part 1. Stephen Fry endures some linguistic punishment with an investigation into the use of puns.
So, now then, Fry, set the tone. Restraint. Always restraint. There's going to be no dreadful wordplay in my opening, as it were. I shall start as I mean to go on. This is proper. This is British Radio 4, the only station which has a programme especially for angry people with bladder problems, cross incontinence. Damn, I couldn't hold it in, I'm so sorry. But puns are as British, English perhaps, as a punnet of strawberries at Wimbledon, a punt on the can. Corporal punish, no, we will not be seduced by the cheap and the tawdry. Not yet, anyway. This programme attempts to understand why our language and culture groans with the weight of punniness. Newspaper headlines, radio and TV programmes, shops and businesses, commercial products. But what is a pun, exactly? I hear you ask, prompted by these my teasing introductory words. A pun, if I may answer you somewhat portentously, is a figure of speech, paronomasia, consisting of a deliberate confusion of similar words or phrases for rhetorical effect, often with humorous intent. To start with, there are simple homographic and homophonic puns. Homographic puns exploit the difference in meaning of words which look alike and usually sound alike. Mr. Arthur Smith will illustrate.
What must you know to be an auctioneer? Lots.
Homophonic puns exploit the difference in meanings of words which sound alike but have different spellings.
I've no idea how worms reproduce, but you often find them in pairs.
A pun can rely on different shades of meaning of one word, polysemy, or the assumed equivalence of multiple similar words, homonymy, or of a literal meaning with a metaphor.
Why did the Marxist only drink herbal tea? Because proper tea is theft.
As I always say, show me where Trotsky's buried and I'll show you a communist plot. In short, the man who treats a homonym as a synonym has a pun in him. Shall we concern ourselves further also with the heteronymic? Shall we debate whether the phenomenon also bears scrutiny as a form of antanaklesis and polypteton? Or ask where dissonance ends and a pun begins? No, we shall not. Nor shall we even consider literary puns, which would be a programme of its own. Enough. Although, the word pun itself is believed to be originally a contraction of puntigrion, an archaic term thought to have originated from punctilius, which itself derived from the Italian puntilio, originally meaning a fine point, diminutive of punto, point, from the Latin punctus, past participle of pungere, to prick. It may sound impressive, but these etymological sources are reported in the Oxford English Dictionary as mere conjecture. No one really knows. What I can tell you with some certainty is that we're going to hear a lot of pricks over the course of the next 25 minutes or so. With whom shall we start? Preferably someone who will not take offence at such a facetious description. We British are trained in puns from an early age. Who amongst us has not had experience from earliest childhood of the joke inside the Christmas cracker? It's as much a part of the festive season as turkey and mince pies, holly and mistletoe, and a lack of snow on the roof of the London Meteorological Office. In 2006, Professor Richard Wiseman of the University of Hertfordshire conducted a survey on cracker jokes through the Daily Telegraph, so he's a most appropriate pundit to whom we can turn.
One of the things we found out straight away is that Christmas cracker jokes really are not very funny at all. So we had, in fact, 65% of our participants never once ticked the yes, this is a funny gag box. So we're really talking about a series of alleged jokes that aren't funny, which is a kind of weird category of joke.
So why, one may pertinently ask, do we persist in doing it?
I think that is a really interesting question. Why it is that this tradition would survive so long when it doesn't make people laugh? Clearly, it's nothing to do with the laughter. I suspect what's happening is that you have a shared experience around the table, that everyone's sitting there, somebody tells a joke, and the nature of the psychology of humour is that any joke will make some people laugh and not others, which isn't a shared experience, isn't a bonding experience. But if you tell a bad joke, everyone groans. We're all in it together. And it also takes the pressure off the joke teller. If you've got a good joke, you tell it badly, everyone goes, oh, you just messed that up, and you feel bad at the sort of family table. You've got a bad joke in your hand, you can't tell it badly. It's a bad joke. If no one responds, no one laughs, you blame the piece of paper, not yourself. So I think there's interesting social psychology.
That would also explain why so many cracker jokes take the form they do, a question, inviting the others to participate in hazarding a guess and an answer that we can all groan at. Dr. Wiseman, as is fitting, has a pungent observation on why this appeals to us British.
I suspect what's going on is that it's a weird British celebration of failure. That the Americans, who, for example, don't have the cracker tradition at all, I spoke about results on American radio, and they couldn't get their head around the idea of a joke that didn't work. And they were fascinated by that. And the host kept coming back and saying, no, let me get this right. You've got jokes that aren't funny, and you all sit around telling them. I said, that's right, that's the tradition. Why would you do that? He was completely perplexed. I think it's about the Brits kind of going, it's all right to fail. Failure is a bonding exercise. We're all in it together. We're not about picking out one person around the table and going, you're the best, you know, you're the successful person we're all going to look up to. It's this rather weird British celebration of failure.
The first mottos that appeared in the first crackers in the 1860s were not punny at all. They were more an inspirational thought or romantic ditty. Half a century would pass before jokes began to infiltrate, as Peter Kimpton, a crackers historian, literally, and former crackers executive, explains.
They were very inventive at following the trends of the day. So whatever was popular, they would produce a box of crackers which reflected that particular theme. I have one here, 1925-26, Christmas motoring crackers. And crackers for golfers, you have so on. In your sweet click, I long to be. Is my desire in vain? Rather than drive me from your tea, oh, puss me out of pain. It's coming in, 1925-26. Mm. You have one here called All Sports, a box which features pictures on the lid of cricket, hockey, swimming, rugby, etc., tennis. I'm not the sort to miss a catch, as you will soon discover. I don't intend to lose the match. You've bowled this maiden over. From just a very few years ago, what's the oldest fruit of all? Elderberries. What do you call a man down in the mouth? A dentist. Terrible. Terrible. What kind of tie does a pig wear? A pig's tie.
And from where have the cracker manufacturers traditionally found their puns? Have they employed professional punsters, out-of-work stand-up artists, very annoying brothers-in-law, Punt and Dennis? Well, for many years, Britain's biggest cracker manufacturers followed the time-honoured tradition of the second-rate comedian and stole them. Yes, your cracker manufacturer is the thief of bad gags.
In my day, the product manager would sometimes refer to a book of jokes, because you can't really register a joke as your own. It's a peculiar thing. Everybody uses them. The jokes go around the block, but nobody pays a fee to use them.
Should, however, a pun originator be tempted to start proceedings for breach of copyright, he would doubtless turn to the legendary Messrs. Sue, Grabbit and Run, a practice which brings us neatly to the book which arguably contains more puns than any other, The Yellow Pages. Dr. Frank Monaghan of the Open University conducts a survey of business names for Yell.com and discovered that certain occupations display a peculiar propensity for choosing punning names.
Hairdressers are the most groan-worthy ones, of course. There were things like Jack the Snipper, Fat Boy Trim, Curl Up and Die. There was one that's slightly risque. It's called A Bit Off the Top, which actually is a topless hairdresser's up in Paisley. There was Hair Flick. So, and even within this, you begin to see certain things. So you get references to TV programmes, Hair Flick, hello, hello. So you get other cultural references that come through the puns as well.
The other great offenders are fish and chip shops, a complete battery of them.
Things like Battersea Cod's Home, which bizarrely is actually in Yorkshire, Rock and Soul Place, Northern Soul. My favourite one, I have to say, is one in Wales called A Fish Called Rhonda. The Godfather, And there's another one called Goodbye, Mr. Chips, B-U-Y, Mr. Chips, which is in Repton, and that's the home of a public school, and so there's a little reference there. Whether there's any record of Robert Donat taking the lower six down to buy fish and chips, I don't know, but they seem to enjoy having that as part of their name.
There was once an employment agency in northwest London called Big Jobs, although it went out of business, and the habit of punning business names seems to be concentrated in a certain kind of trade.
It tends to be largely around services, though, I must say, so that you will get things like gardening shops, petal pushers is one, gardening services, there's a very nice one called Mud, Sweat and Shears. We came across one called The Lawn Ranger. There was a shop called Ello Flower, which is in Yorkshire. So again, you've got, again, a linguistic thing going on there that's there. And there was a nice tree pruning one called the Tree Amigos. And again, that's another film reference, so that may or may not survive as time goes on. Food shops are another source of them. You get, there's one, I think it is in Birmingham, called Baghetti Junction. An interesting Indian restaurant called the Korma Sutra. And there was another, a plumbing company called Bodgett and Scarpa. So they're relying on people's sense of humour, but, you know, there's this whole subgenre, I think, where the negative associations are made, and you wonder how popular they will be. So there's, for example, there's a house clearance company called Klepto & Son. My favourite one in that classification was a drainage company called Success. So we can only speculate, really, that what it does do is it gives you, you know, an instant recognition. People may be struck by the humour of it, and they will then remember it.
But we can't groan with pleasurably feigned exasperation unless we have a stern, disapproving voice telling us how naughty we are even to entertain the notion. Listen to John Humphreys on the Today programme the day after the 2007 budget.
And the time now is 23 minutes to 8, and if you dislike puns, you'd better look away now or possibly off on account by the newspapers this morning, because their thoughts were mostly centred on this idea of the 2P. We have reasons 2P cheerful, is what the Sun says. The Daily Mail has a different play on puns, really. What God giveth, God taketh away. Rather a nice line on the front page of the Daily Mail.
The Independent tries to top the puns with 2P or not 2P.
The tabloid newspaper headline is, of course, the perfect format. Haiku-like in impact and brevity. Anthony Clavain is sports writer of the Sunday Mirror. Let him remind us of the sports headline writer's finest, but not briefest, achievement. In a cup match in 2000, the mighty Glasgow football team Celtic had been beaten 3-1 at home by the lowly Caledonian Thistle side. And the headline the next day?
Super Cali go ballistic. Celtic are atrocious. That is the legendary headline of all time. But I'm sure that the person who wrote that was waiting for years and years and years before he had the chance. We know that readers will remember the great punning headlines. This is the great sort of myth, really. I'd like to claim that the writers write the headlines and write the puns, but sadly, we don't.
It is, of course, the unnamed sub-editors who are these unsung literary giants.
I suppose this is the art of the pun, isn't it? Trying to, in one word, say something funny, come up with some kind of wordplay which summarises a mood, a match, a moment. I think that the reward is that they are known amongst their peers as a fine headline writer, a fine punster. There are awards now in many sports journalist awards which include the category, you know, headline of the year. So those headline writers are now beginning, I think, very belatedly to be recognised.
Talking of newspaper puns reminds me of a man who entered a local paper's pun contest. He sent in 10 different puns in the hope that at least one of the puns would win. Unfortunately, no pun in 10 did. No pun intended, oh dear. Anthony Clavain reminds us of other dangers inherent in the practice.
Rodney Marsh found that out when he made this pun after the tsunami had occurred, and he managed to compare the tsunami to the Newcastle United fans, who are known as the Toon Army. Because he made that pun so close to the tragedy of the tsunami, Sky sacked him. So, you know, punning can be bad for your health.
What is good for your health is laughter. The best medicine, as that famous gardening magazine, The Weeders Digest, used to have it. And someone providing that medicine in regular doses is Vine, the stand-up comedian.
I like short jokes, personally, and it just so happens that puns and wordplay fit quite well into the short joke thing. So if I go Black Beauty, he's a dark horse, or if I say, I never sleep with fish, I'm halibut, it's all over and done very, very quickly, and we can move on to the next thing. So people can, if they don't like it, here comes another one, you know. It's not the long lead-up. So it just happens. I don't like just like puns, really. It's just that puns happen to be, it's work better if they're short. I read in the newspaper the other day, in the obituary column, it said Mars bar, packet of Rolos, double decker. Then I realised, in fact, I was reading the obituary column. Now that's the kind of thing I like. I mean, I said, you know, that there are all male tennis players are witches. For example, Goran, even he's a witch.
But does he see this as a particularly British tradition?
I think the British do have an affinity for this sort of humour. I mean, look at the Carry On films, of course, they're absolutely full of them all. Why are there snakes on your windscreen? Those are my vipers. The great Frankie Howard joke in Carry On Up the Jungle or whatever it was. I think it is just because we were the first people to have the English language, so we've played with it for the longest. I know that in France they have puns. I do know one French pun that apparently is done quite a lot. When someone says, I'll see you tomorrow, and they go, demain, they often hold up both hands and go, demain, as in two hands. It's not hilarious, which is why you don't have carry-on films in France.
Tim Vine tours with a one-man show called Current Puns. So for him, it's compulsive then, is it, this urge to turn everything into a pun?
Yes. It does become a bit excessive that everywhere you look, you see a sign. And, you know, like I was in a shop the other day and I saw the sign said menswear, and I saw it as men swear, you know, and you do begin to see things. Or you see lavatories. I saw it as lavatories, and I imagined all these conservatives in volcanoes. And I mean, you know, and I've tried all these things on stage. Not all of them work. Apparently, I found out recently that if you suffer from the compulsive punning, you're a paranomasiac. Yes, I think I must be. I certainly am in bouts.
The trouble with miniaturisation in humour, as in anything else, is that very small things are easy to purloin, and at least two people have been accused of nicking Tim Vine's jokes, making them, I suppose, a pair of knickers.
People sometimes say to me, am I flattered having my jokes endlessly stolen? It's a bit like saying to someone, that burglar must have really liked your DVD player to steal it. I mean, that must count for something. Well, not really, no. I suppose it is slightly flattering. And strangely enough, when these things do end up floating around the internet for a length of time, you actually feel slightly less ownership of them, which is sad because they do belong to me. But that's one of those things, you know. The key is to keep writing. You keep writing and people keep nicking it. That's the trouble. There's too many people out there who can't be bothered to write jokes. My sister made up this. When I was getting into my car, this bloke said to me, can you give me a lift? I said, sure, you look great, the world's your oyster, go for it. My sister made that one. And then, of course, this one's definitely mine. I went to the butcher. He said, I bet you £10 you can't reach those two bits of meat. He said, I'm pointing outwards, by the way. I said, I'm not betting. He said, why not? I said, the stakes are too high.
In 2004, Tim Vine's joke-writing skills led him to breaking the Guinness World Record for the most jokes told in an hour. 499 rib-tickling quickie quips, which works out, to those of you who may be government officials, as more than 8.3166 laughs a minute. Others of us can only let fall our jaws and admire a veritable joke machine, the very thought of which might strike one as oxymoronic. But if it did, banish such thoughts. Such a thing actually exists, dear listener, and if Tim Vine can rattle out more than 8 a minute, this joke machine can punish him with more than 10 times that amount. Some 5,000 puns an hour. It is called stand-up.
Please wait while I think of a joke. Why is a majestic field different from a gaudy shrimp?
Why is a majestic field different from a gaudy shrimp?
One is a proud lawn, the other is a loud prawn.
One is a proud lawn, the other is a loud prawn.
The human voice there belongs to Dr. Graham Ritchie, Senior Research Fellow at Aberdeen University, who is one of the team from three Scottish universities who worked on stand-up, which is an acronym for System to Augment Non-Speakers Dialogue Using Puns. Dr. Ritchie explains its origins.
Certain children are very limited in their ability to play with language if they've suffered from something like cerebral palsy or some kind of accident which has impaired their speech abilities or their motor coordination. Children like that very often communicate with the world through a speech synthesizer in a very laborious way. So it makes it very difficult for them to play with puns and jokes with their friends. So we thought if we gave them a computer that could make puns and that they could control, that would give them a playmate and it would help them to explore language, find out about words meaning the same and sounding the same and so on.
Although the machine might be prolific, it doesn't do it quite as we humans do it.
I think it's quite hard to draw any comparison between this program and how humans do it. We have just built the model in a way which would appear to work. In other words, we've done it from linguistic information rather than psychological information. We've looked at the structure of these jokes to see what the linguistic relations are between the words and phrases. And then we've devised rules which are faithful to those patterns of linguistic relations. Now, there's no notion that this simulates how people think these things up. And I don't think there's much evidence about how people think these things up. Despite having thought them up myself, it's very hard to introspect and know how you've thought them up. Any kind of joke which can be constructed using ambiguity can be done by using phonetic similarity as the route to achieve the ambiguity. So some people would say these are puns, some people might say they're not puns because they are more broadly ambiguity-based jokes. A couple of parrots are sitting on a perch. One says to the other, "Can you smell fish?"
So what does make one joke better than another?
I don't know the psychological literature on reaction to puns. I do know of one study where the researchers asked people to rate a number of puns for how funny they were. However, it was only one study and it was very narrow because it only looked at one class of pun known as the Tom Swifty, which is a one-line pun in which you attribute some remark to a character called Tom and then you add an adverb about how he said it, and there's a pun across between the adverb and what was said. So, for example, "Turn up the heat," said Tom coldly. Or, "I don't know what to buy in the supermarket," said Tom listlessly. Now, those were the kinds that they looked at, and depending on how complex your words are, you can get more than one link across between elements in the text, and they found that the more links, the funnier people found them. But it's very hard to generalise that to anything beyond that kind of joke.
But perhaps the existence of artificial intelligence creating scripts with a joke structure can give us an insight into what makes a pun funny. Ah, to attempt to explain that is like trying to grab a handful of fog. We can try, though, where others have only missed. Missed? Dr. Ritchie first.
There's not much agreement on why these are funny. Various suggestions have been made. Well, one suggestion is they're not very funny at all. But beyond that, it has been suggested that in a pun you bring together two very disparate ideas and force them together, and so the clash of the ideas results in humour. Alternatively, sometimes you're just very impressed with the cleverness of the pun. So some of the more intricate ones make you laugh because of the ingenuity of the construction.
Tim Vine?
I think the best type of wordplay is the one that creates the most surprise. I suppose most jokes involve some sort of surprise. You're led one way and then suddenly pull back the other way. And so the best ones, I guess, are the ones where in the shortest possible distance you've created the biggest change of direction. "I've got a bit of moon rock. When I broke it open, it had moon written all through it."
And Dr. Monaghan?
It's a very cheap form of metaphor, isn't it? It's an attempt to make links between things that are a bit dissonant and actually to make it stick in your mind. So I guess it's Dryden called them the most grovelling form of wit, didn't he? So it's that level of metaphor, perhaps, that is at work that makes people remember it.
Incongruity, ambivalence, brevity, classic theories of humour, all to be found in such a little thing as a pun. So, simple enough to be replicated by a machine, short enough as to appear insignificant, the lowest form of wit that in the hands of a master can be elevated to magical status. For my own part, for what it's worth, I think the best puns should work on the level of language and on the level of meaning. Like this example, what's the definition of a mistress? Something between a mister and a mattress.